I don't know what Saruman thought was happening, but anyway, he did not know how to deal with it. His wizardry may have been falling off lately, of course, but anyway, I think he has not much grit, not much plain courage alone in a tight place without a lot of slaves and machines and things, if you know what I mean. Very different from old Gandalf. Merry, Flotsam and Jetsam.
It is episode 56 of the Grey Company Podcast. My name is Derek, and tonight we continue our book club series with the next three chapters of The Two Towers, Helm's Deep, The Road to Isengard, and Flotsam and Jetsam. Joining me tonight is three out of the four Grey Companions. Tonight we have Ian all the way on the West Coast. How are you, sir?
Not bad. I just think fate always conspires to make sure that we don't have the full company.
I was thinking exact same thing.
Saruman's foul hand is...
Devilry of Saruman. Yeah, we were supposed to have Matthew, all four of us, on tonight, but then Matthew sent us a text just a minute ago that his power went out. Come on.
It's because everyone in Phoenix is running their air conditioning right now or something.
You got to open up the windows, cool down the whole city. How are the Tea Time Tales going? I haven't been able to keep up, unfortunately. That's a great new feature you're doing.
Oh, thanks. A lot of fun. I took a little bit of a 2-week break just for holidays and being sick and whatnot, but went back to it this past Friday. And the best thing about it is it just forces me to constantly come up with new decks in a good way. So it shakes me out of sometimes you just get stuck playing the decks that you know work, and this kind of forces me to have a bigger variety of decks.
Well, speaking as a civilian, I appreciate that kind of thing, because I've just given up on deck building. RingsDB has spoiled me. I was never good at it in the first place, so I just defer to guys like you and Dan and C Stan and everybody else. So I salute you. Also joining me tonight is the Big Bad Bear himself. Dan, what's up?
Not much, man. Kind of still trying to transition back into normal life, coming back from vacation. So
yeah, you got to go overseas, right, for a holiday?
Yeah, Portugal for 2 weeks. It was fantastic.
That's excellent.
Wanted to give a shout-out to Manuel and Nuno, two members of the community that were nice enough to meet up with Mrs. Bjorn and I while we were overseas. So we had a great time in Portugal, and part of that was a big thanks to some of the fine members of the community. So thanks, guys.
Excellent. Very cool. And speaking of Europe, we got an email a while back, and this seems like a perfect opportunity to share the news. Some of you who are around the community over there in Europe might have heard about the Lure of Middle-earth event. So quick plug for that. That is the largest LOTR LCG event in Europe. Over 100 players were there last year playing the Lord of the Rings LCG and even the Middle-earth the Wizard CCG. So if you find yourself in Germany in March, make sure you head to the Lure of Middle-earth event. It's lureofmiddleearth.com for our European listeners.
I think that's the one they do at a castle, isn't it? Castle Stalik.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, they also have a big Game of Thrones tournament each year there. But yeah, I think that's where it is. So you're playing Lord of the Rings in a freaking castle. If I was in Europe, I would definitely go.
Oh, you're right. Castle Stalik.
Epic as it gets right there.
Holy cow. All right, so patrons, you need to call me up and just kidding. Please don't leave us.
Oh, Patreon. You give and you take away.
All right. Well, back here in the mainland, we are continuing our book club. As I said at the top of the show, we are going through Helm's Deep, The Road to Isengard, and Flotsam and Jetsam. And for those of you joining us for the first time, or if you just need a reminder, the way we usually run these episodes is we go chapter by chapter. I give you a quick summary of what happened in that chapter. We discuss it, and then we see how it ties into the book. or excuse me, we see how the book ties into the game or vice versa, however I'm supposed to say that, and kind of evaluate how the game has, how well the game has tackled these iconic moments from The Lord of the Rings. So tonight we begin with Helm's Deep, speaking of iconic. So here's a quick summary of what happened. Slightly different from the movies, so if you have only so if you've only watched the films, maybe pay attention.
Like, where are the elves? So where's Haldir?
Which is funny because we'll talk about this in a moment, but Legolas even says, "Oh, I wish I had 100 archers from Mirkwood."
That's right.
And Peter Jackson was like, "So you shall." But anyways, so here's the summary. We encounter the host of Edoras making for the fords of Isen to assess the situation and then proceed to Isengard to confront Sauron. Remember, this is just after Gandalf and the three hunters, you know, burst into Mediseld and snapped Theoden out of whatever witchcraft wizardry Grima had imposed upon him.
It was definitely a condition attachment. I'm just throwing
condition,
that out
there. Before they're able to get to the fords, I should say, they learn from an outrider, Kaoril, that the defense of the fords was broken by an enormous army. Erkenbrand and his men fled the scene. Gandalf then reroutes Theoden and his army to Helm's Deep, where they hold out for the night against the massive army of Uruks, Half-Orcs, and Dunlendings from Isengard. In the morning, the enemies find themselves caught between an assault from Theoden and the Rohirrim, Gandalf and Erkenbrand, and then a mysterious forest that appeared at the exit of the valley. And that ends the Battle of Helm's Deep. All right, so obviously this is an iconic chapter. It's one of the, it's the first massive battle of the book. We've gotten some skirmishes with the Fellowship, but this is the first of the big battles, the first showpiece, if you like. Where should we start with this one?
Whew. Where to start?
I don't know.
a lot going on here.
Well, let's start with Helm's Deep itself. So it's clear in the book that Helm's Deep was not constructed by the Rohirrim. It was constructed by the Numenoreans, or Gondor at its height, the height of the Gondorian Empire, when what is now Rohan was actually a province, Kalanarthon, of Gondor. And it's made clear that the construction is almost is magical in the way Tolkien talks about magic, right? So it's the wall is basically sheer. The book says that you can't, you know, someone trying to ascend the wall wouldn't even be able to find a foothold because it's that sheer. But there is that dreaded culvert. But part of what the mystique of the book is for all of us is that pointing backwards. And so I love that Helm's Deep itself is pointing backwards to Gondor at its height and to the Numenoreans that actually built this thing. So I love that part every time I come to it.
I feel like one of...
Yeah, it's kind of... Go ahead.
I feel like one of the things, just a small point, but one of the things that has helped me enjoy this chapter a lot more over the years is just quickly Googling a map of Helm's Deep, because I personally, yeah, I find the geography of it is potentially confusing. There's a Helm's Gate and a Helm's Dyke and a Hornburg and all these different parts. So I suggest when reading this, have a little map alongside that you can find. A quick couple Google searches. Maybe I'll put one in the post of the actual episode, but helps to figure out what is happening where.
Yeah, and I love even when it's all said and done, Gimli's talking about, like, he just is, you know, waxing poetic about the glimmering caves, and everyone else is like, what the heck are you talking about? You know, this huge battle just happened, and everyone's obviously really focused on that, and he's, you know, being totally dwarfing out over there, just, you know, in awe of the beauty of these caves. And it's one of the first times you get an insight into another side of Gimli's character as well.
Yeah, he geeks out a little bit. But I like, along the same lines, he even kind of, as magically and wonderfully made as Helm's Deep is, he still finds a way to correct it, and he says, give me a year and 100 of my kin, and I would make this place a place that armies would break upon like water. So even though there's this, I would not want to be a Rohirrim listening to that, where, you know, all my hope is placed in this one big old wall that's keeping the armies of Isengard out, and Gimli's kind of like, yeah, I could do better. You would not want to hear that.
I think it's just such a perfect setting for this part of the book. In what is essentially, like, it is, you know, the quote-unquote turning of the tide, like, that this is the point that was pretty much going to be the end of everything. This huge army, like all the odds against them, they were basically going to die, which would have been the death of Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli and Theoden and all the Rohirrim. Like that's pretty much all she wrote for the war, I think. Like even if they managed to slam dunk the ring, like what are they coming back to at that point? Just the fact that they're able to obviously turn it around by the end of it. I don't know. Just the whole thing works so well as both a chapter and a quest. Just this feeling of like just holding on by the slimmest of margins just until the night is over and you can.
Fitting for this game.
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned that, Ian, because that I think this was the first saga quest when I really was kind of gobsmacked and just said, wow, they're going all in on, you know, it's such an, you know, we'll get into it a little bit later, but the mechanics are so novel and it captures the idea of a siege and it turns some of the core assumptions of the game kind of on their head, and it just has this big epic feel to it. So it really is an example where the game absolutely captures the books, I think.
Yeah. So yeah, I expect the battle itself we'll kind of cover more when we talk about the quest. So one of the standout thing apart from the Battle of Helm's Deep itself, one other thing, but one of many other things that I really liked about this chapter is this is the first time we see we already heard about Gimli geeking out over the glittering caves and has opinion about Numenorean architecture. But then during the battle, you hear the famous dwarvish battle cry for the first time, the Baruch Chazad, Chazad Imenu. And it's that excited me a lot the first time I read it, because we get this one, it's totally badass. but also it's another peek kind of into the culture of the dwarves, which is intentionally very closed off. So just getting to imagine him running here and there shouting, huzzah, huzzah, which just means dwarves, dwarves. So I love that their own name is kind of like their battle cry. that's just one of the many moments that got me really pumped up, was the dwarvish battle cry.
Yeah.
And you sorry if we keep buttons.
We're just making your editing job really hard.
Go for it, Dan.
Oh, just that in that moment that you're describing, I can totally in my mind picture him, you know, running headlong, you know, like a maniac at, you know, a dozen orcs and just not caring. He's like, you know, who's first, basically.
Yeah, it was just perfectly captured by the Hazad Hazad card from way back in the Moria box, which gives a dwarf character zero cost, giving a dwarf character +3 till the end of the phase. So you can go dwarf berserk at your leisure in the game.
Yeah, the battle itself is really cool. Obviously, it's iconic, but I like that it's just made up. It's not, like, drawn out that long. Like, if you look at the chapter, it's not, like, a hugely long chapter.
No.
But it's just...
The chapter moves so fast.
It's very, just, like, very memorable, like, individual, like, cut scenes, for lack of a better word. Like, coming out of the postern gate and attacking, and the wall being blown up, and, you know, all these moments that are very memorable. But it's very punchy. It's not, like, some very long, drawn-out thing that I think a lot of people kind of conceive of it that way if they haven't read the books in a while.
Yeah, and yet somehow I agree with the pace being breakneck, and somehow some among the Rohirrim managed to doubt Gandalf yet again, even after he's won over Theoden.
Yeah.
To where when he shows up at the end, you know, spoiler alert, guys, they're surprised, and he's like, why are you surprised? I said I was coming back. It's just such a funny moment to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they couldn't wait, like, essentially one night before they're starting to lose hope in Gandalf coming back, and he brings Erkenbrand and a whole, you know, host with him.
Yeah, that's funny. I actually had that in my notes to talk about, because before they even get there, before when Gandalf it has left, there's kind of this, like, talk among Theoden's guards, and one of the guards who's not named is basically, like, you know... basically casting doubt on Gandalf that he's just taking off and he's not going to come back, you know. But I think on the other hand, Gandalf does rely on, like, people a lot of, he makes people put a lot of faith in him, because if you think about it, like, they don't really know him that well. Like, he's just kind of, if they know anything, it's just kind of this figure in the stories, this wizard who shows up and he's basically like, yeah, the battle's coming, see ya, just wait for me. Like, I'll be there, I swear. But yeah, I think we also see kind of some of the remnants of Wormtongue's influence, and I'm still sad I miss talking about Worm Tongue last episode, but
well, he's coming back, so you'll have him.
I'll manage to pepper in some mentions here and there. Yeah, but it's just, it's one of the, this chapter is mostly just a big battle, but one of the questions that I think is there is kind of how much, I feel like we've talked about this over and over, but how much does Gandalf know and when? And so in this case, how much is Gandalf just kind of flying by the seat of his pants and let me go see who I can rally up, and how much does he know? There was one particular point that I completely missed until I got to the Flotsam and Jetsam chapter and then went back, which is that Gandalf actually sees probably what he knows to be the Huorns, because there's a part at the very beginning of the Helm's Deep chapter where they see a
let's talk about that.
A shadow nearby Isengard, and so when I was first reading through, I was like, okay, that's just like Saruman's evil influence or the orc army or whatever. But then the exact quote is, Legolas is watching it, says, "I can see a darkness, there are shapes moving in it, great shapes far away upon the bank of the river. But what they are, I cannot tell. It is not mist or cloud that defeats my eyes. There is a veiling shadow that some power lays upon the land." So when you hear that, I'm like, okay, that's Saruman. But then he ends it saying, "It is as if the twilight under endless trees were flowing downwards from the hills." So by the time we get later to Flotsam and Jetsam, you can kind of put two and two together that Gandalf actually, I think, figured out what was going on there.
Yeah, there's one other related kind of premonition around how important the Ents are going to be that I noticed early on in this chapter, where they talk about the orcs coming with like burning brands, essentially, that they have fire and that they're taking it. I might even say mention that they're taking it to the trees, but it's just, it kind of sets it up that you know that, hey, like, there's a due, you know, there is a debt that's coming due that has nothing to do with the men in this battle. There are larger things at work in Middle Earth at this very moment. As this, you know, obviously the men are so focused on the battle as the thing, but you know, when all of a sudden the battle's over and they're looking, you know, they look to one side and they're like, "Hey, where did this forest come from?" It's a reminder that there's things that are outside of their control that are happening.
Yeah, and that's kind of summarized nicely with Theoden's little speech when he sees the Ents at the beginning of the next chapter. But you're mentioning the torches made me think that there are a lot of really nice catchphrases and just really good, not throwaway lines, I'm trying to think of the right word to say, but really great lines given to the Rohirrim. So like when they meet Gamling, and Gamling says, "If they come to bargain for our goods at Helm's Deep, they will pay a high price." But then one of the archers says, "We loosed every arrow that we had and filled the dike with orcs, but it will not halt them long. Already they are scaling the bank at many points, thick as marching ants, but we have taught them not to carry torches."
Yeah. That's a great line.
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, we think of the Ent attack on Isengard as being pivotal, but it's one of the big differences between book and movie here is how important that Huorn presence at Helm's Deep is. Like, even with Erkenbrand's charge and Gandalf, I'm not confident that they would have won that battle without the Huorns being there to kind of just scare the orcs witless to the point where they run away and just get all killed. Like, maybe the surprise they might have won, but I don't know. I feel like the Huorns basically won the Battle of Helm's Deep and Isengard, and it was just a matter of them having to hold out long enough for them to arrive.
Right.
Yeah. It's probably another example of kind of the eucatastrophe that Derek likes to mention. It's such a recurring theme in Tolkien stuff. These you know, men in particular in his world like to think of themselves as the center of everything, when in reality they're just one very small part of something much bigger. I found the quote that I was thinking of, by the way, as far as the what I consider probably directly talking about the motivation of the Huorns is it's Theoden speaking. He says, "They bring fire and they are burning as they come, rick, cot, and tree." And it's just one sentence, and you can see it as kind of a throwaway. And it's like, well, if you're burning trees as you go, and we know after the fact that the Huorns like don't even care about Saruman. They're really just about like, get me to these orcs. That's their their driving motivation. And this is really just fuel on the fire, to forgive a tortured metaphor there. The orcs essentially in doing that as leading up to the Battle of the Hornburg are sealing their own doom, is what I would say.
Yeah, that's true. Something else I'd like to touch on that maybe we should talk about the quest is this element of not we kind of talked about it last time, not really superstition, but the fact that Middle Earth is still an enchanted place. So when Aragorn stands and brandishes Andúril, like all the orcs kind of and the enemies kind of stop for a second and hesitate because there's this, you know, this historic sword is here. And then when the horn of the keep is blown before Théoden makes his charge, the orcs, you know, kind of hesitate again, and all the riders shout, "Helm, Helm, Helm has arisen and comes back to war. Helm for Théoden King." Which, if you didn't read the appendices about how crazy awesome Helm Hammerhand was, you need to do that right now, because the man just went around and killed people with his bare hands. But this idea that, like, you know, their great ancestor is coming back to fight for them, or I love that kind of not really mysticism, but I love that element of otherness and enchantedness to the people and the various groups within Middle Earth. That always gets me excited.
Yeah, well, I think, I guess to put it in more modern terms, like Tolkien really, you know, I'm not a big military buff or military historian, but someone who is maybe will pick holes or have problems with like battle tactics or whatever with Tolkien. But I feel like his big thing is he's primarily concerned with like the psychological aspect of right. warfare, to put it in a modern way. To put it in a less modern way, it's like these symbols, these myths, like even the fortress itself, they keep talking about how it's never fallen, and that has a force of its own to bolster their kind of their drive to keep holding on to it, even though at a certain point Théoden has that great quote about how shall any tower withstand such numbers and such reckless hate. I just love that phrase, such reckless hate. But
and it's a terrible treachery card too.
So I'm glad they picked that particular phrase out, because it's memorable both in the movies and the books, I think.
Yeah.
It's interesting you would reference that, actually, because that was one of those, you know, we were talking earlier about the great quotes in this chapter. Mm-hmm. Like that phrase, reckless hate, was always one of those ones that I thought Tolkien chose for the kind of poetry of the way it sounds. Mm-hmm. But this time through reading it, I realized that it was intentional, because one of the things that, you know, we've talked about the orcs, but like the Dunlendings are the other main component of the army, you know, that is assailing this, you know, this fortress that has never fallen as long as it was manned. And the whole reason that they're there is that Saruman subtly over years has been manipulating them and taking what was a mistrust. You know, if we go back to the earlier times of this being the northern realms of Gondor, that, you know, the Dunlendings were bitter that the Gondorians gave this as a protectorate to the Rohirrim. They wanted to have that region for their own. And so Saruman, you know, plays into that and stokes this hatred. And that's how he's able to get the Dunlendings to join in with orcs
yeah.
in a battle. And so that reckless hate phrase now, like, I think it rings a little bit truer to me than it, whereas before it's kind of struck me as poetry. And now I realize there's something to that, is that there is an element on both sides when you bring the Huorns, or however you say that, into it, is that there's hatred as a motivation on both sides of this battle.
Yeah, it makes me think that now that we're talking that phrase, reckless hate, because I agree with you, Dan, it's always been a phrase I liked, but I wasn't sure quite why. Like, what does that really mean? But I think whether Tolkien intended this or not, I think it's also a commentary on almost like how the two armies are different. Like the Rohirrim is very much like the kind of old style, like noble knights, almost, you know, a code of honor, and this is how we fight, and according to these kind of very honorable means. Whereas the orc Saruman's army is a very modern army, and not in the sense of just technology, but in the sense of like, let's throw tens of thousands of quote unquote people. they're orc people. Let's just throw them at the enemy and who cares what happens to them. Like, that's the reckless part of it, is like, you know, their bodies are being piled, but they are just throwing themselves in ways in a style very similar to World War One, which Tolkien was kind of familiar with. but it's very much that modern, like, World War One style of like, just let's just throw our people at the enemy because we don't care what happens to them. Whereas the other side, the Rohirrim, the free peoples, are very much not that, yeah, that reckless style.
Life is a fungible resource on one hand and something to be cherished on the other, like a real, yep, contrast there. Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Well, shall we talk about the Helm's Deep quest? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. So this came out within the Treason of Saruman saga box, and man, such a big quest. Where to begin?
Yeah. Such a good quest. It is. It's one of my favorites, I think.
Yeah. I was really scared because before it came out, because how could they possibly do justice to such an iconic scene? But I feel like they did. It's definitely in my top 10, maybe even top 5 of Lord of the Rings quests.
Yeah, you knew, like, the first quest stage gives you a free ally, and before I'd even looked at the rest of the cards, when I saw that, I was like, oh, boy.
That's never like, a good
sign. Anytime they're giving you something that big early on, especially if it ends up being, like, a really expensive, powerful ally, like, if you get a free first turn Gandalf or something, you're thinking, oh, yeah, I got this, and then you realize, like, okay, you're in for such a, you're in for such an onslaught.
I mean, we talked about how the whole theme of this battle is just that they just need to. Someone mentions that at some. I think maybe it's in one of the chapters before this that Gandalf talks to Theoden about how it's just a matter of holding on until the ring bearers can do their thing. But even in the smaller scale, it's just a matter of holding on for this one night until Gandalf can get there. And the way that they flip things so that you're holding off them making progress, like, that was just perfect. That does exactly what it needed to give you that feeling of, like, I just need to hold on a little bit more.
Yeah. So the defense keyword, I guess, is something we have to get into here. I'm actually going to pull up the rules sheet because I don't want to butcher it when I describe it, but it's essentially turning, kind of inverting the whole questing concept in the game, and it's right. it's on all the quest cards in this. Sorry, I'm just pulling it up. I don't trust my memory. There's too many cards in this game now to trust my memory to anything. Defense. Here it is. Okay, so represents the army of Saruman laying siege to Helm's Deep in their efforts to capture the fortress. So while the current quest has the defense keyword, players cannot place progress on the quest or active location by questing successfully. Instead, the encounter deck tries to place progress on the current quest. If the encounter deck defeats stage 4B, the army of Saruman captures Helm's Deep and the players lose the game. So it's exactly what you guys are talking about, where you're really just trying to hold out. You don't want them to get all the way through all the quest stages. So it's a total inversion of the game where we are trying to stop the encounter deck from making progress against us, essentially.
Yeah, it's awesome.
One of the cards that stands out to me is Devilry of Saruman. I have a love-hate relationship with it. I hate it because it's bad, but I also, this is the one that basically puts kind of automatic progress on the quest stage. So it can have some feel-bad moments, but I also think it adds kind of an important part of the battle to the quest, which is that feeling of, like, just when they think they have things shored up, like, the wall gets blown up and they get, you know, it's this feeling that no matter how secure you think you have things, it's that unpredictable element that the quest needs, I think.
This is one of those cards that has been the source of so many tears in the history of this game, because it's the three auto progress, you're right, can definitely be feel bad, but the part that is so brutal to me is almost every deck I will ever make is reliant on synergy between my heroes and other cards that I'm playing, and this, until the end of the round, treat each character's text box as blank.
Oh, it's brutal. Traits. Yeah.
It is so bad when you're like, oh, I could ready, no, I can't. I could... No, I can't do that either. Nope, can't do that either. yeah, it really shuts down pretty much every deck out there. It's like you said, though, Ian, it leads to some really epic moments where you're never safe in assuming, okay, I've got this, we can hold off the tide.
Yeah, I've had some games. I think the one I played for the campaign series on Tales from the Cards was this one, but where I was like holding steady on quest one and there was just the chain of events, including that card, where all of a sudden it advanced all the way to like stage three or stage four all at once. Like, it was insanity. Yeah, but it made for a nice finish.
Make sure there wasn't anything else we wanted to talk about for this quest before we talked about some other cards. Nope. Right, so this is the chapter where Kaoral is introduced. So the Kaoral ally is... I don't know. I like him. That's because I like Rohan cards. But just as a refresher, he's a 2-cost leadership ally. 1 will, 2 attack, 2 hit points. And his action lets you spend a spirit resource to ready him and then give control of him to another player. Any player may trigger this action. So this is one among the kind of first batch of cards that started to mix and match spheres to trigger abilities. So, I don't know, you get the name out there, but I've never found anything too tremendous to use him for.
Yeah, it's a fun theme that they played with earlier in the game with one of the other Rohan allies, of being able to give them to another player, which I think is cool. And it seems fitting in this, where you've got all these guys running around trying to help each other out.
So he can help out in a pinch, especially, you know, in the combat phase and things like that. But anyway, it's nice to have him out there. One other card that I didn't put in the notes but kind of goes along with this chapter is Keeping Count. This is the first chapter in which we're introduced to Legolas and Gimli's little contest that's happening, where they're measuring their their kill count against each other, which is, of course, the inspiration for the oft-neglected Keeping Count card from... was that from the core set or just the first cycle?
First cycle, I think.
Yeah. There have been some fun decks that played around with that card, but it's another one where it's more novelty than utility. But it's a cool card.
Yeah, it definitely is one of those cards that's a callback to such a great moment in the books that I always kind of wished was a little better or worked a little bit more consistently, because it is such a... It's, I think, one of the beginnings of a deeper bonding between Gimli and Legolas that we see. I mean, we've been mentioning it kind of throughout, but you start to really see it there where they, you know, there's something about bonding through, shared experiences in battle that I think it makes sense that you would get a much deeper friendship that way.
Cool. Any other cards or anything else we want to talk about with Helm's Deep before we move on?
Go ahead, Ian.
There was a couple, we don't need to spend a lot of time on it, but I saw a couple of card name drops. One was Ever My Heart Rises. We get the mention of that one.
Oh, yeah.
Is Gimli being close to the mountains makes him feel better, which ties into the card. And then also Knife Work, when Gimli runs into Legolas again, he's like wiping off his bloody knife, because I guess it's been at such close quarters that it's been knife work, it's been not bow work anymore.
Yeah, and I think he's almost out of arrows at that point, too.
Yeah, Tolkien already makes Legolas such a badass that it always kind of bugs me with the movies where Peter Jackson, I feel like he's trying to go way overboard to do that, especially the later Mumak stuff or whatever, and you don't need to.
Yeah, you really don't need to.
The source material is such a badass. But
he's already OP.
Yeah. Gambling the Old is mentioned also in this chapter, and his ally allows you to, it plays into the core Rohan mechanic where when you discard, you can kind of bring him back, and that's another fitting one where there's kind of like rallying the troops or whatever.
Yeah, you get some good recursion with him.
It's interesting how now between that and Guthwine, which is another kind of iconic thing, Éomer's sword that's referenced in this. They both name their swords basically at the end.
Guthwine for the mark.
Exactly. Like, Guthwine, and I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, but my old English is rusty, is also playing into that kind of recursion mechanic that Rohan seems to have now. But I actually built a deck. It's just more of kind of a theme deck around this chapter, and it is up on RingsDB right now. It's just called Book Club Episode 56, Helm's Deep. So anyone that wants to see one take kind of inspired by the Rohirrim in this epic battle, you can check out RingsDB on that.
Cool. Yeah, we'll link that in the notes as well. All right, let's crack on here. It's time to take the road to Isengard.
Hobbits to Isengard.
Never gets old. This chapter picks up right where Helm's Deep left off. Immediately following the battle, the heroes wonder at the amazing forest that has appeared. They pass through it the next night as they proceed to Isengard. Gimli recounts the beauty of the glittering caves. They see Ents calling each other and herding the trees. Theoden kind of freaks out along with everybody else. Orders are given to clean up after the battle. They march off to Isengard to finish the business they started. They pass by the fords of Isen and see a very strange thing pass by, which we already kind of alluded to. Upon reaching Isengard, they see the results of the attack of the Ents and encounter the Dor wards, Merry and Pippin. So this whole set is, this is one long series of events, really, from the time we reach the Golden Hall. But really, Helm's Deep, Road to Isengard, and then Flotsam and Jetsam really bleed into each other quite a lot. But anyway, one of my favorite things about this chapter is just the banter between Legolas and Gimli we get, where Legolas is geeking out about Fangorn when it's apparent to him that the Ents and the Horns are from there. And then Gimli's geeking out about the Aglarond, the Glittering Caves. But then they make this bet that if they survive the war, they'll each take the other to the respective places to kind of enjoy one another's perspective. So that's great. I love to see the development of their friendship. Just kind of like as you were saying when we were talking about keeping count, Dan, that being brothers in battle really glued them together and blossomed what was already a growing friendship.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where the question popped up in my brain, like, why would Tolkien choose to spend so much time on it? It's a pretty lengthy back and forth between them after this big epic battle and when there's still Sauron to go. Like, and I feel like, probably because I do love Tolkien as an author, that I think he does most things intentionally. And in this case, I think it's... I mean, obviously it's building up their friendship, but I also feel like it's in this darkest moment. Obviously we've talked before about this whole theme of like, you're not going to go back to the world you knew before and things are going to be marred in some way, even if you survive. Like, that's kind of the dark, like half empty part of this whole war that we're seeing. But I think this is the other part of it, which is like, it's almost like the what are we fighting for moment, because they're sharing with each other these things they love, like these caves on one hand, and Legolas the wanting to explore Fangorn and his love for forest, and it's almost like them holding on to the things they love in this like big nasty war, and that having this hope that they're going to be able to share that with each other afterwards.
Yeah, it's always struck me as a line that I would suspect has happened many times between comrades that have gone through battle, is they say, hey, like, we make it through this. I'm going to take you to see my favorite thing where I'm from, and you take me to see your favorite. And even if we don't appreciate the other's favorite thing as much, we kind of want to through their eyes. Like, there's a real bonding there. And I always took it as this delicate balance of, like, it means on the one hand, they just came through this huge battle, so they don't necessarily want to let themselves think that they could come through the entire war, because they know that there's more to come, but they also want to have that little bit of hope and optimism and saying, hey, like, if we make it through this, like, I want you to, you know, Gimli is saying, I want to take you back there and I can show you why it's so amazing. And Legolas is saying the same thing about Fangorn. And it's like you said, Ian, the love is really a central theme of one entire side of the battle, whereas hate is really hate and a desire for power and a desire to possess the One Ring and control Middle Earth is behind the other force in this battle.
Yep, for sure.
On that same note, we see that same contrast starkly between the Rohirrim and the Dunlendings when the battle ends and the surviving Dunlendings surrender, they're surprised because the Rohirrim basically just have them contribute to burying the dead. They confiscate their weapons and then kind of take an oath. You know, as you mentioned, Ian, they're on this chivalric system. And then they say, that's it. Just no longer ally yourselves with the enemies of men and don't cross the border in arms ever again. And that's it. And the Dunlendings are like flipping out, you know, because as Dan noted, the Saruman had tricked them and said that the Rohirrim were terrible and cruel and they would burn their captives alive. So it's another hit you over the head with the contrast between good and evil moment. That's also really cool.
Yeah, it... What's also striking about that is how there's such a firm line drawn between men, even enemy combatant men and orcs.
Yeah.
Because although the Dunlending dead aren't given quite as much of a place of honor as the Rohirrim dead, they do get their own mound, whereas the orc bodies are just thrown in a pile, basically. And there are no orcs left, but you can imagine they would not have been treated as mercifully as the Dunlendings if there were survivors. So obviously there's like, you know, the orcs are... I think this goes back to the whole conversation of how Tolkien conceived orcs, at least at this point, and whether or not he would have changed it later. The fact is that they are clearly not in the circle of forgiveness. Like, right. Like they are not in the same like level as men. Like they are just enemies. That's it. Throw them in a pile and they're not deserving of much more consideration than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the opening quote uses the word slaves and I'll bring that word up again is I've always seen it as the men, the Dunlendings are tricked and they're given, you know, under the circumstances, fairly reasonable terms, just giving up their arms and having to make an oath, whereas the orcs are seen as slaves that are really just the arm of Saruman, and they're destroyed, every last one of them.
Yeah. I'm really curious how Tolkien might have changed that conception if he would have written Lord of the Rings later in life, but... just knowing of what I know of how he was kind of thinking about that more later on. But I think it's just I think you hit the nail on the head, Dan, that they don't have any agency of their own. At least that's what it comes down to, is how others view them, that they are just kind of automatons of Sauron. And so they're not worthy of kind of the mercy that you would give to creatures who actually have like free will and the fire of Eru and whatever else you want to call it.
And especially the half-orcs and the Uruk-hai, because they seem to be specially bred by Saruman just to fight and to kill and to destroy Rohan specifically. And that kind of leads us along the road to Isengard, where we get a description, much like Helm's Deep, we get the description of Isengard and the Tower of Orthanc, and how it was an outpost of Gondor. It was maintained by the Gondorians until Saruman took it over. And then not that many years prior to when we encounter it here, Saruman started making so-called improvements. And we get a pretty cool picture of the relationship, even though it's just a glimpse, between Sauron and Saruman, where the improvements that Saruman made are described as a copy or a child's model of Barad-dûr, the Dark Tower. And let's see.
Yeah, it's such a great description.
Yeah, it says, is it right here? For what he forsook his former wisdom, and which fondly he imagined were his own, came but from Mordor. And again, that's not specified why, but we later learn that the connection between Sauron and Saruman is the Palantir. So even Saruman was deceived and bought into this lie of Sauron that, you know, he could make some improvements and make a power of himself. Then of course Saruman double crossed him. But yeah, that description is very powerful and very gives us more of an idea, more rounds out the character of the bad guys in the book.
What really stands out to me about that is I love that kind of description that it's just a pale imitation. But it's funny because if you pull the string back further in time, like Sauron is a pale imitation of Morgoth, right? Yeah. Like he's building his right. own, his Barad-dûr to kind of compete against the Angband and Morgoth's big fortresses of the past. And mm-hmm. Morgoth himself could be said to be a pale imitation of Eru, like he was trying to do the things that Eru did, which is create life, and he was never able to because he doesn't have that sacred fire that he needs to have. But you know, coming back to Saruman, you see those same sins that he tried to create the Uruk-hai, kind of a new creature, just as Morgoth and Sauron did before. But that's almost like the cardinal sin, according to right. to Tolkien and kind of this whole elven mythology.
Yeah, and it's funny that it always stems from hubris, yep. right? Like he has this arrogance, like, oh, I can fix this where other people have failed. And, you know, just by controlling it and just by my wisdom, right? He's, you know, Saruman is very much about his own wisdom. And in the story we hear from Gandalf earlier on in the books about their meeting, it's apparent to Gandalf that he's left the path of wisdom, but he doesn't see that. And so this pale, like this child's copy is such a great description because you think of it like a kid who doesn't understand something but is emulating it is really what I think of. And so when you talk about these, you know, like lower and lower fidelity copies. It's such a great way of thinking of it. It's like yeah. the echoes throughout history where Morgoth was the original hubris to say like, oh, I can do what Eru the Allfather did and create life. And he creates this perverted, warped version of life. And then, you know, it just gets increasingly more childish, these copies throughout history, until you get Saruman, who's, you know, basically completely deluded.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, there's a lot of overlap in these chapters, mm-hmm. so I want to talk about the horns passing by in their mist, and it's, you know, it's mentioned in Helm's Deep, and it's going to be mentioned again in the next chapter, but we actually see the heroes at the Fords of Isen trying to catch some sleep, and then this terrifying thing happens where basically these two streams of mist, and there's talk of voices being in there, pass by, and then Merry later says that... he thinks that that's how the horns get around. They're able to kind of shroud themselves in shadow. And in Helm's Deep, when the trees show up, they ask if it's wizardry. And Gandalf says, no, it's a far older power than wizardry was, which is a very interesting thing. It kind of goes back to our discussion about Ents in the previous episode and the relationship between all these different pieces. And I don't know. I wonder if it's even worth trying to quantify. What does it mean to be a far older power than wizardry? Obviously, trees are older. They were a part of the original creation. But what power do they have? How does that power work? I don't know. Those questions can be fun, but I wonder if it's I wonder how far down that path we want to go.
Yeah, the best answer I could give is just that how the Ents and presumably the Huorns were given these powers to protect nature originally mm-hmm. against the dwarves, but it turns out that who they really needed to protect against was the orcs, but. Yeah, so I guess maybe it's some kind of, like, Valar-granted power. I don't know. That's the best I could come up with.
That's always how I've interpreted it without going down the wormhole, is just that Yavanna basically said, look, I want the things that are beautiful in Middle-earth to continue, and so let me have these shepherds or, you know, herdsmen is one of the words used in this chapter to ensure that the flocks, so to speak, of trees are kept safe. From all the things that would kill them,
and I
like that they verge on the realm of fairy tale internally with the story, because that's what Theoden's little speeches in the previous, or actually the beginning of this chapter, when they see the Ents, he talks about how all these things are springing to life around him that he thought were previously children's stories. So to me, the idea of these trees that can kind of come in by the shadows and devour orcs feels very much like, you know, one of a Mad Baggins' tales being told around the campfire after a couple drinks. But I like that he bleeds and blurs the line between myth and fairy tale and reality and all those stuff. It's a very nice effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else do we want to talk about before we get into Flotsam and Jetsam?
There, there's one theme that I noticed that I'd never noticed before that I want to just touch on briefly, is that there's a repetition in this chapter that I hadn't seen, which is he's talking about graveyards actually quite a bit in this. And, you know, we mentioned it briefly earlier, but that he first talks about graveyards of men, essentially, and then one of the actually named characters that has died is Hama has received his final errata and has been buried. And then so, you know, they talk about honoring the dead, and Erkenbrand's there, and Grimbold, and all these other elf, you know, they mention Elfhelm being sent back to Edoras and all these other things, but it's the men are honoring their dead. And then they talk about the graveyard of the orcs, and as we said at the top on this chapter, that's the way the contrast in the way that the orcs and the men are treated is pretty important. And then the last thing you have is you actually have the graveyard of the trees, where as they're approaching Isengard, they get to see what has happened. Let's see. Among the rank grasses could still be seen the burned and axe-hewn stumps of ancient groves. It was a sad country. So you actually see this repetition, and they don't necessarily recognize that last one as a graveyard, but very much to the Ents and to the Horns, that's what it is.
Yeah. That's a good point. I hadn't noticed that. At the end of The Road to Isengard, we meet Merry and Pippin again. We hadn't seen them since for a little while now, since they were marching off to war. And while Gandalf and Theoden and the Rohirrim ride off to meet with Treebeard and find out what's going on with Saruman, Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli, and the hobbits reunite. The remainder of the Fellowship reunites, and they partake in some of the stores of Isengard, including the Pipeweed, and then Merry and Pippin share the tale of the Ents' attack on Isengard.
Yeah, we get the actual attack on Isengard as a story or a flashback, essentially, rather than seeing it directly in the movie.
Yeah, it's a really satisfying moment for me to finally have this, you know, and also how low key it is, where they're just sitting there on a pile of rocks and they're not even noticed at first, and you have the three hunters reunited with the hobbits that they were hunting all that time.
And Gimli's not happy about it.
I think one of the lines in this chapter that sticks out to me the most is that basically Saruman left the Ents and Huorns out of his calculations. Like, he empties out Isengard completely, leaving it defenseless and just letting them, because he had no, like, he knew they existed, obviously, but he had no idea they were capable of this because he didn't understand them. Like, he didn't understand how they would react and what they were capable of. And it's just, again, that contrast with Gandalf, where, because to Saruman, I think he left them out of the calculations because they're not important. Like, they're not, they're not something he can use for power. They're not kind of these gears and wheels or powerful artifacts that he can use. Whereas Gandalf is the complete opposite. Like, he has everything in his calculations, especially the people that are forgotten, like hobbits and ants that are forgotten by everyone. Like, those are the people that are always in his calculations. And that's why he comes out on top.
That's a really good insight, because early in one of the earlier chapters, Treebeard actually tells Pippin and Merry that he used to come around, and once he had asked enough questions, he just stopped coming around and didn't, you know, it was always a one-way relationship. And it's exactly what you're saying, Ian, where once Saruman got everything that he thought he could from the Ents, he just writes them off as, oh, there's no more, I can't control them directly, I'm not going to be able to trick them, because they have, you know, the Ents obviously have their own motivation that's very distinct from his, and so he just ignores him. To his ultimate
fault. Yeah, that was a big mistake.
And I love how the Ents just tear, you know, I mentioned two times now, Helm's Deep and Orthanc, how strongly built this Numenorean architecture is, and the Ents just wreck it. Because they, you know, this whatever their natural power is, it's like the weathering of rocks in a second. Yeah, the battle, I'm really glad that we get the visual of the battle in the movies, because it's just such a great moment. But Merry and Pippin's recounting of it is great as well. And then, of course, at the end, we find that we get a little bit more news. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I had to make sure we get to this. That just before the heroes arrived at Isengard, so did one Grima Wormtongue.
Yes, he did.
Who was presented with a nasty choice. Treebeard says, "You can wait for your master," meaning Theoden King, "or you can swim and go be with Saruman," and he chooses to swim.
Oh, it's so beautiful. That whole, the way that he describes it and the way that, like, Grima begrudgingly goes, okay, and then he's like, I'm gonna drown, and Treebeard's like, no, you'll be fine, we'll watch you. So beautiful.
Well, I like how Grima's trying to do this thing of like, oh, I'm sent to deliver these plans, and then once he sees Isengard is wrecked, he's like, actually, there are no plans, can I just go? Can I be dismissed? Yeah,
it's so good.
Yeah, he bolts, and then Treebeard just scoops him up off of his horse.
Yeah, never has news become more more irrelevant than him going to tell the, you know, oh, this is what the Rohirrim are doing. Oh, never mind.
I'm sick at that. I guess I'll say it here, since I wasn't in the past episode. Just kind of the one interesting aspect of the Grima character is, I think the way, obviously he's just kind of this like sniveling weasel type character, but the way he actually turns people against Gandalf in the earlier chapters is interesting, that he doesn't like try to recruit them for Saruman directly or try to recruit for them for evil. It's just a thing of like despair as his weapon. Like there's no way to win. Gandalf is, who is bringing the bad news, is cast as like the evil one for bringing up the injustice or the badness that's happening. Like that is right. Basically his weapon is casting, like, you are telling us about this bad stuff and bad stuff is happening, so you must be the evil one. And
we get some of that too from Saruman in the next, or whatever. Yeah. The next chapter, Voice of Saruman, where it's kind of the same thing. The Rohirrim that are just standing around are like, yeah, Gandalf kind of sucks. You know, they're deceived.
Well, I think it's this thing of like, even when things are really bad in the world and you know they're bad, like they know there's a Sauron there. It's not like they can just dismiss that, but it's that kind of human nature aspect that can be preyed on of like, well, if I can find a way to have my head in the sand, I'm going to. Like, if I can find a way to preserve what I'm doing and not go to all this trouble of a big war and struggle against this thing, then I'm going to. And that's exactly what Wormtongue plugs into.
Yeah.
Even just finding a convenient target in a scary time is very powerful.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they talk about the power of Saruman's voice and his ability to sway the minds of men. And you got to be careful for anyone that agrees with whoever the last person that spoke. Like, that's a dangerous thing right there.
But going back to the attack of the Ents, it's interesting because we talked about the contrast between love and this reckless hate. But then in the Ents, we see, I don't know if I'd classify it as hate, but it's some strong fury and righteous anger, I guess is what I would call it.
Hastiness.
There's this part where I think it's Quickbeam who says this, but he I think he's the one who chases after Saruman and also gets him. But he's basically shouting like, tree killer, there's the tree killer. For some reason that makes me laugh, and I also like that moment. But it's like, I think it's in the Ents we see the power that a kind of like righteous anger, like I said, can have, that it rouses them to do these amazing feats that need to be done.
It's almost like nature versus industry too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that battle.
Yeah, there you could definitely take this as some kind of like championing environmentalism if you wanted to, which I think is probably one of the reasons why Lord of the Rings, when it was first released, resonated with a lot of people, is that was you know, just kind of a new idea in society, is really looking at things, seeing the damage that industrialization had wrecked on England, and Tolkien even talks about, you know, his appreciation of and it comes through in the book, his appreciation of, you know, just the rural wild England allowed to remain wild and beautiful and free, and contrast that with this idea of machines and the, you know, the gears and the grinding kind of juggernaut of inevitability of technology. And I mean, that's the reason why I chose the opening quote on that, is I feel like Saruman definitely represents all of those things. And the Ents being ultimately, I agree with what we said earlier, where ultimately they're the unsung heroes of these chapters, mm-hmm. rather than the men thinking that they won the battle. And I feel like it's such a great contrast, as you have this desire to control and strip, you know, whole hillsides are stripped bare of trees. And then Saruman's, that's really his undoing, because that's what kicks the Ents' anger and righteous fury into overdrive, is seeing whole hillsides, you know, quick beams, whole area where his trees that he watches over, is that most of them are dead now because of Saruman.
Mm-mm-mm. I think it's also significant that the Ents are shepherds, like fundamentally what that's what they are. I don't think that's an accident. Again, the same theme again, that like Saruman is a master. He seeks mastery over machines and people and anything he can control. Whereas the Ents are shepherds, like they tend, they take care of, they can ultimately guide this kind of force of nature we see in the Huorns in different directions, but they are definitely not like mastering and controlling them or shaping them in a kind of very forceful way.
Yeah, it's I really like that, and the game does a good job too, because Huorns show up as enemies in multiple different quests, and I think that's great because it shows you that, like you said, the Ents might guide them, but it's not like you're gonna, you know, be playing Huorn characters out of your player card deck. Like, that's just not the way it works. You don't have control of them on that level. It's more just kind of you know, force of nature, I think, is a great expression for it. It's this thing that's happening, and you hope that it's happening in the direction of your enemies, because you don't necessarily have complete control over the outcome.
The eagles are like that too, which is why I like that a lot of several of the eagle cards fly away after you use them. Just that idea that like they are wild creatures and they're dangerous.
Yeah, it's a really nice theme that he has there, because it makes it more interesting than just, oh, all the free peoples are gonna join up and just get along and sing kumbaya. It's no, there's these elements that end up helping the main characters at various points, but not in the sense of completely giving up their own agency and their own motivations. Like, Treebeard is there for the trees, and that's why he stays ultimately, and they move on and their story carries on, but he's not gonna, you know, march all the way to Mordor with them. That's just not that's not what his motivation is.
They're gonna get on a boat. But no, there's a great line where oh goodness, of course I can't find it when I need it, but the Merry is describing what happened prior to the battle at Isengard, and you see the horned dark, as Merry aptly calls it, heading south to Helm's Deep, and Treebeard says, their business is with the orcs, our business is with Isengard, or with Saruman, whatever he says. It's just like you said, they got one purpose, they got one motivation, they're going to get it done.
And I think we definitely get the answer in this chapter too. What exactly Gandalf was doing and how much he had to do with the Huorn showing up, which we see that he actually talks to Treebeard and I imagine asks Treebeard to make sure the Huorns find their way to Helm's Deep. So again, Gandalf saw far quickly, very quickly enough to put the pieces together. And I think, although it's not like he can see the future, I think it's more like, whereas Saruman doesn't understand the Ents again, Gandalf does, and he knew that this was probably a very likely possibility. And once he saw the Huorns in the distance, he kind of figured out what he needed to do.
It's at the end of Helm's Deep where he says, they're like marveling at Gandalf's wizardry. And he says, wizardry, all I did was give good advice and make use of the speed of Shadowfax. And that's just what you're saying. He sees the pieces moving and he just happens to have a hyperdrive horse so he can get from place to place and give commands.
And say that way.
The greatest project manager. Yeah. Project manager. That's really what it comes down to. He's like, he's a logistical genius.
Anything else about Flotsam and Jetsam before we talk about some cards?
It's a really minor detail, but I want to actually bring it up because it's another one of those things that ends up being super important down the road. Is Aragorn, when they're all, you know, the three hunters are meeting with the two hobbits, and they're, you know, telling stories and welcoming each other and sharing food and pipeweed and whatnot. And he gives them their daggers of Westerness that they lost along the their terrible time with the orcs being kidnapped. And it's just this one random sentence there, but it ends up being very relevant later. So
that's true.
Look out for those daggers. They might play a part later.
Never know.
This quest, this chapter, is mostly encapsulated in the Road to Isengard quest, which is both the Ents attack on Isengard and then a confrontation with the voice of Saruman kind of rolled into one. So there's a lot going on here. But my favorite thing about this quest, I only played it a couple times, but I very distinctly remember the beginning where you get to recruit the Ents. You get to have your little moot and spend your time kind of rousing the Ents that... then to be used during the quest. And I absolutely love that mechanic. Because, as always, it's cost-benefit. You can take the time to try to recruit these guys, watch your threat go up, among other things, or you can just forge ahead. But they are such strong allies that I know I always made sure that I made the time to recruit the Ents of Fangorn to be used later.
Yeah.
Such a perfect hit as far as theme, because I remember playing it and intentionally using hobbits, because the way that you get them is you have to use the hero's willpower to try and win over the Ents to your side. And so there's something so beautiful about using hobbits with, you know, their combat stats are not good, they don't have a lot of hit points, they're not, you know, these impressive heroes, but you're using the willpower to win over the Ents, and then the Ents are amazing at combat and are going to help your cause. And it's such a great moment where the game kind of lines up with the story.
Absolutely.
I thought of this scenario as a tough design challenge, even compared to Helm's Deep, because in the books, you know, the Ents do this all themselves, whereas obviously you can't really do that in a quest. So I thought it was a good balance to give you the chance to recruit them, and then you can kind of pursue an alternate history of taking whatever characters you want and putting them through this kind of assault on Isengard.
Or just build an Ent deck.
Or you could build an Ent deck, well, yeah.
I don't know if we had I don't know how many Ents we had back then when this box came out, but
yeah, this is one of those quests that I want to go back and play thematically, because we've had it spoiled that there's going to be a quick beam here, and I think it would be awesome to actually do like a Tremere quick beam and then all Ent ally and just go like all Ents all the time on this quest and see
that'd
if
be great.
That would be fantastic.
The other thing I really like here is Saruman is a card and an enemy. Mm-hmm. I really like when they can find ways to make enemies that aren't just a big bucket of hit points and like just choose through them.
Amen.
Like he's not that tough in terms of like defense and hit points, but he attacks often through his staff. He gets extra shadows and wizardry effects. And then there's that cool alternate loss condition of getting eliminated on the last stage if you don't have any cards in hand. So I just think it's an interesting boss battle that feels different than a lot of other boss battles, which it should, because Saruman's a different kind of enemy to face.
And all those wizardry effects are just nasty, too.
Oh, yeah, he's so annoying in this quest, which I think is perfect. I'm trying to remember. I think they came out with Aristor after this quest, right?
I think
so. Because I just remember the humor of like, oh, let's bring Aristor to Atreus and Saruman.
Oops.
Yeah, it's a home run on that one.
Yep. And we get the great Grima enemy who can just pop up at any moment, give you some problems, and then disappear, which seems very fitting for him.
Yeah.
With one engagement cost is one of the details about that card that I always thought was amazing, is he's just like obnoxious. There's nothing you can do to avoid him.
Have we ever played this quest with the Grima hero?
So that it's Grima and his brother Brima or something?
just you know.
Or it's Mirror Universe.
Yeah, exactly. Mirror Universe.
I'll just paint a goatee on the card. But then is he so the funny. Evil one or the good one at that point? I'm so confused.
Yeah, it's really it's hard to tell.
This whole meta game you got going on.
We need to get you a Team Greenman t-shirt. I feel like this needs to happen.
That's funny. Anything else about these three marvelous chapters before we wrap this one up?
Just grateful that the game nailed the quests related to these chapters so completely.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel it's so hard to say because so many of the saga boxes are good, but The Treason of Isengard is up there. It might be my favorite saga box as far as the quests go. It's just it just really hits everything on the head, I think.
Yeah, Helm's Deep in particular is one of those quests that I will go back and play just to kind of have that experience.
Sure. All right. Well, this has been episode 56 of the Grey Company podcast, brought to you by our patrons. If you'd like to help with us with hosting fees, etc., please get to patreon.com/greyco to sign up. We appreciate your support. As always, you can get in touch with us through our website at greycompanypodcast.com, and from there you can connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, Twitch, etc. We're also usually hanging around the Cardboard of the Rings Discord chat at any given time of day, so you can catch us on there as well. Please send your emails to thegreycompanypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to read your questions and comments on the air. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, farewell.